cuts at the state level that have pushed voting restrictions. And, you know, now he's giving money to Leonard Leo, who is, you know, we understand Side considers himself to be a libertarian, but, you know, Leonard Leo is a staunch social conservative who has, you know, built the Supreme Court to tear down abortion rights in this country. So, you know, we see that he's funding a very, very radical right-wing program.
And education?
Well, so he's funded a lot of, we believe, some universities. He appears to be the donor who gave $20 million to rename George Mason University's law school after Antonin Scalia. You know, we see that he was frequently emailing with professors there, with one he was particularly friendly with, as well as the dean. And, you know, you could see that they were quite eager to please him. He's also been, we believe, a donor to Hillsdale College, which, you know, has come up in recent years, and that it's helped undermine the idea or undermine the science related to COVID. And it's also served as sort of a feeder for the Trump administration for jobs there.
Why these two universities and colleges in particular, Hillsdale College and George Mason University?
Yeah, well, so with Hillsdale, we understand that that Barry is quite interested in the great books curriculum, you know, these kind of Western classics. With George Mason, it's a university that is politically influential. It's right outside the nation's capital, and it's become, you know, this sort of Supreme Court university. It's the law school is named after Antonin Scalia, and then we see that judges Clarence Thomas, Brett Kavanaugh, Neil Gorsuch have taught there in recent years as well.
We want to thank you, Andrew Perez, for being with us, senior editor and reporter at The Lever. We'll link to your new expose with ProPublica, How a Billionaire's Attack Philanthropy Secretly Funded Climate Denialism and Right-Wing Causes. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for a People and Culture Manager. If you are or know someone who's interested in HR, please go to democracynow.org and apply at that website, or send it around to others you know. Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Fels, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Maria Tarasena, Trina Nadura. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Stay safe.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO's Board of Directors is delighted to invite all KBOO members to the annual membership meeting and Board of Directors elections. The meeting will be held on Saturday, September 17th at 1 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street, Portland. A Zoom link and call-in access will be provided to those who are unable to attend in person. This is the opportunity for all members to meet the candidates, get station updates, and make their voices heard. Again, that's KBOO's annual membership meeting and Board of Directors elections, Saturday, September 17th at 1 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm/meeting2022.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, with greater concern sparking and more wildfires, people in Oregon may have to go without power. It's the last day before a strike for some local teachers. How men are getting involved in the dialogue about sexual violence. And the passing of the longest-serving monarch in our nation's history, Queen Elizabeth II. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, September 8th, 2022. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us tonight. Wildfire worries may lead to widespread voluntary power outages, and these could affect thousands of Oregon residents, as KBOO's Josh Salem reports.
Pacific Power has issued a potential shutoff notice to customers in six Oregon counties. because of gusty weekend winds and the risk of wildfires. The company notified about 12,000 customers in Linn, Douglas, Lincoln, Tillamook, Marion, and Polk counties of a potential public safety power shutoff from early Friday through Saturday. Communities potentially impacted include Lebanon, Sweet Home, Lincoln City, and parts of Staten and Glide. Portland General Electric also said it is increasingly likely it too will shut off power in 10 areas because of the risk of fire. That would impact upon some 30,000 customers. Utility officials said, quote, PGE will continue to monitor conditions for the next 24 to 48 hours and will provide an update. If conditions persist, PGE aims to provide up to 4 hours of notice before turning off power, end quote. Fire weather watchers and red flag warnings have been forecast for much of western Oregon and Washington starting Friday. While the concern isn't as great as it was during the Oregon 2020 Labor Day Fires East Wind event, officials remain concerned about new fires and rapid spread of existing blazes. Officials in Washington State said yesterday that an east wind event is also expected over the weekend that could, in conjunction with already critical weather conditions, result in severe wildfire activity. The Washington Department of Natural Resources said, quote, west of the Cascades, this will likely be the highest fire danger of the season as hot, dry winds leave normally damp fuel such as grass and moss ready to burn and primed for rapid spread, end quote. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
Queen Elizabeth II, the longest-serving monarch in British history, has passed away. KBOO's Jeffrey Wade has more.
Queen Elizabeth II died peacefully today at her castle in Balmoral, Aberdeenshire in Scotland. She was 96 years of age. Queen Elizabeth served as monarch to the United Kingdom from early February 1952 until today. Her reign of 70 years and 214 days marks the longest-serving British monarch and the second longest of a sovereign country. Born Elizabeth Alexandra Mary in Mayfair, London, 1926. Elizabeth was the first child of the Duke and Duchess of York, who went on to become King George IV and Queen Elizabeth, with her father acceding the throne in 1936. In November of 1947, she married Philip Mountbatten, the former Prince of Greece and Denmark and future Duke of Edinburgh, whom she remained married to until his passing in 2021. Elizabeth became Queen Regnant of seven independent Commonwealth countries in 1952, following the death of her father. Under her rule at that time included the United Kingdom, New Zealand, Canada, Australia, South Africa, Pakistan, and Ceylon, known today as Sri Lanka. During her reign, Elizabeth presided as a constitutional monarch through several significant political shifts, including the Troubles of Northern Ireland, devolution in the United Kingdom, the decolonization of Africa, and the UK's accession to the European Communities and eventual withdrawal from the European Union in 2020. Events marking the Queen's coronation included celebrations of her silver, golden, diamond, and platinum jubilees in 1977, 2002, 2012, and 2020, respectively. Though largely beloved by her country, Elizabeth faced public adversity during her reign, significantly following the breakdown of her children's marriages, her annus horribilis in 1992, and following the death of daughter-in-law Diana, Princess of Wales, in 1997. Throughout her long and memorable reign, Queen Elizabeth II retained major popularity from the public, with support from the UK's monarchy remaining consistently high. She is succeeded by her eldest son, Charles III. For the KB Evening News, I'm Jeffrey Wade.
Today marks the last day of bargaining for Washington's Ridgefield teachers before they go on strike tomorrow if they don't reach a deal. The deal on the table would increase wages for Ridgefield educators by 16% over the next 3 years, with some employees seeing a potential increase of 30%. Back in August, union members representing the Ridgefield Education Association, or REA, unanimously authorized the executive board to call a strike if warranted. Since September 1st, REA-affiliated teachers have been back to work without a contract. They have cited burnout and unsustainable learning resources for students, a need for updated COVID-19 protocols, and a lack of learning resources for students, prompting the looming strike. Union spokespeople spoke Wednesday saying progress was achieved, though details involving areas that impact student learning and teacher workload are still under consideration. Richfield School District also updated its bargaining webpage, adding a frequently asked questions section for parents, helping to illustrate how a strike could impact a shortened academic year and basic school operations. Today's bargaining session was the third this week, and unless key agreements are met establishing new contracts and scholastic recommendations, a strike tomorrow appears likely. High-level negotiations for a new Indo-Pacific economic framework are getting underway, and they're expected to bring protests in Los Angeles similar to those that took place in Chicago during the negotiations for the Trans-Pacific Partnership in 2011. As Suzanne Potter reports, labor advocates are pressing for more transparency, fearing excessive corporate influence.
Labor and environmental groups are asking for a seat in the room where it happens as government trade representatives gather today in Los Angeles to begin negotiations on the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework. The IPEF, as it is called, is a massive trade deal between states on the Pacific Rim that would govern an estimated 40% of the global economy and impact people's jobs, wages, digital privacy, climate change, and more. Will Welchko with the California Trade Justice Coalition says the public has the right to know what negotiators are proposing.
You know, in past trade negotiations, hundreds of corporate lobbyists have been given access to the negotiators, the draft text, and the public was completely shut out. And that's a system for delivering rigged trade deals that benefit only a few multinational corporations while hurting working people and the planet.
The Trade Justice Coalition is holding a rally today outside the conference in hopes that future negotiations will include consumer, labor, and environmental advocates. The U.S. Secretary of Commerce, Gina Raimondo, said in a statement that discussions will center on four pillars: trade, supply chains, clean energy, decarbonization and infrastructure, and tax and anti-corruption. Welchko is calling for transparency to moderate the influence of big tech in particular.
These companies are trying to use trade deals as a backdoor means of blocking regulations on consumer privacy, data security, algorithm discrimination, and gig economy worker protections.
This represents the initial rounds of trade negotiations between 13 countries, including the United States, Australia, Brunei, India, Indonesia, Japan, the Republic of Korea, Malaysia, New Zealand, the Philippines, Singapore, Thailand, and Vietnam, but not China. I'm Suzanne Potter.
The presidential election in Brazil is fast approaching, and the future of the Amazon rainforest is at stake. For more, we go to global citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. On October 2nd, we will have a presidential election in Brazil of enormous consequence for the planet. The election will, among other things, decide the fate of the Amazon region's tropical forests, the lungs of the earth. Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, popularly known as Lula, will be seeking the presidency for a second time. During Lula's tenure from 2004 to 2010, Amazon deforestation was reduced by 80%. If his opponent, current President Jair Bolsonaro, should win re-election, rest assured that the cattle owners, soybean growers, loggers, gold diggers, and racist landowners who have been responsible for forest destruction will have the government's full support. Bolsonaro is a Trump lookalike who has been singularly responsible for the continued destruction of the Amazon and the violence against indigenous people and their supporters, most recently the murders of a British journalist and his Brazilian guide who were doing research for a book on protecting the Amazon. He has also taken aim at democracy itself, following Trump's script of questioning the election results in advance, aligning with the far right, and accusing political and civil society opponents of being communists. Bolsonaro's fondness for the two decades of military rule in Brazil, 1964 to 85, is well known. An Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report in 2021 shows that as global warming increases, the capacity of carbon sinks to absorb carbon dioxide from the atmosphere lessens. Bolsonaro has not heeded that lesson and probably could care less. During his rule, indiscriminate clearing of forest land by fires, along with reduced rainfall, has turned the lungs of the earth black. A carbon sink has become a net carbon emitter. Fires consumed an estimated 5.4 million acres of Amazonia last year, so that Brazil showed a net gain of almost 10% in carbon emissions, putting further strain on the planet's ability to cope with climate change. In 40 years, one study concludes, the Amazon has lost an area as big as California to deforestation. Some scientists suggest the Amazon is now close to a tipping point, at which it will become a savanna rather than a rainforest. One reported estimate is that the tipping point could be reached in a decade if deforestation, which already has impacted 17% of Amazonia, increases to between 20 and 25%. Bolsonaro is hardly the first Brazilian leader to put extraction of the Amazon's resource wealth ahead of either the region's indigenous people or planetary well-being. Nor is he the first to try to bait the international community with threats to play or pay. It's the old game of thieves. He's dangling stolen property, the Amazon is ours, he has said, before the world in hopes of compensation he can pocket. There must be fair payment for environmental services provided by our biomes to the planet at large, he says. It's extortion, and he might just get away with it. Back when Joe Biden was a candidate, he called on the world to offer Brazil $20 billion to end deforestation in the Amazon or face economic consequences. Bolsonaro called Biden's comment a cowardly threat. Let's hope Biden doesn't repeat that offer. He's dealing with a carbon criminal. Lula, by most accounts, will win the upcoming election. Though well aware of what happened here on January 6, 2021, he believes that Bolsonaro will not attempt a similar coup. Lula said of Bolsonaro, quote, "He's a poorly made copy of Trump. Trump also tried to avoid accepting the result. They tried to storm the Capitol, but he had to back down, and I'm certain that here in Brazil, the election result will be accepted without any kind of questioning," unquote. Still, rumors abound that Bolsonaro might not accept the results and might stage a coup. "A new class of thieves has emerged who want to steal our freedom," he said in a speech this month. "If necessary, we will go to war." Bolsonaro, a former army captain, has plenty of generals on his side. And some senior military commanders are members of an election commission set up to find and prevent supposed fraud. Senator Bernie Sanders is concerned enough that he has crafted a Senate resolution to make clear that the United States will, quote, "not be supportive with military aid and will not be recognizing an illegitimate government if there's a coup in Brazil." Sanders is absolutely right. Bolsonaro must not repeat the Trump formula of election denial. Otherwise, Brazilians will be condemned to more years of authoritarian rule and Amazonian destruction. Thanks for listening. I'm Mel Gertov for The Global Citizen.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with author Tom Hartman about his new book, The Hidden History of Neoliberalism, How Reaganism Gutted America, and How to Restore Its Greatness. We'll follow that up with Noise Filter, your public health podcast. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, Ethnobotany, Cultural Fire, and Indigenous Stewardship with Richard Bugbee. Tonight's weather, clear skies, a low near 55. Tomorrow's weather, sunny and hot, a high near 91. During the weekend, hotter on Saturday and sunny with a high of 95, and Sunday cooling off a bit as the clouds roll in, the high reaching 87. Today in history, on this date in 1974, President Gerald Ford pardoned his disgraced predecessor, Richard Nixon, for any crimes he may have committed or participated in while in office. Ford told the House Judiciary Committee he wanted to end the national divisions that erupted over the Watergate scandal. The pardon was widely condemned at the time, but decades later, Ford was awarded the Profile in Courage Award, the Kennedy Library Foundation praising him as putting his love of country ahead of his own political future. The quote of the day is from former President Gerald Ford, who declared after taking the oath of office, "My fellow Americans, our long national nightmare is over." An initiative called Engaging Men is bringing new voices into the dialogue about sexual violence. Brett Pevita reports is bringing men into the conversation both as survivors of sexual violence and allies to its victims.
An initiative at one Ohio nonprofit is taking on the topic of men and sexual violence. There's a false notion that men are not experiencing sexual violence or are only perpetrators of it. But a 2015 study indicated nearly one quarter of men experienced sexual violence in their lifetime. At the Ohio Alliance to End Sexual Violence, the Engaging Men Initiative is trying to bring men into the conversation. Engaging Men coordinator Javon Howard is hosting a monthly Instagram live event he calls Q&A with Jay. He says breaking through pre-existing beliefs is a big part of the project.
This issue of sexual violence, especially around male survivorship and male victimization, we don't culturally think that it's real, that it's something that ever happens, and men feel that for themselves as well or about other men.
Howard hosts the live Q&A on the Ohio Alliance to End Sexual Violence Instagram page at OAESV. It's the second Wednesday of every month at noon. Howard says the event offers a safe space for both men and women to learn about resources for survivors and anti-violence strategies. Most questions currently come from women, but he's hoping to get more men involved.
It helps kind of uplift and change the narrative a bit that, okay, maybe this space is for me to be a part of. Maybe I can ask questions. Maybe it's okay for me to explore this topic safely.
More information can be found on the Ohio Alliance to End Sexual Violence website at oaesv.org.
U.S. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer announced Wednesday that a bill codifying same-sex marriage into law will be addressed in the next few weeks. Schumer says he prefers to address the subject separately from a must-pass government funding bill and hopes it wins the votes of at least 10 Republicans needed to pass it. The Senate returned to Washington following an August recess, and majority leaders now face the challenges of how and when to hold votes on key topics ahead of fall's midterm elections. Priorities remain to extend government funding past a September 30th deadline, along with a same-sex marriage bill ahead of November's ballot. The question of extending government funding past September 30th could result in a shutdown, prompting many lawmakers to treat the same-sex legislation as a separate topic. Momentum on Capitol Hill has accelerated concerning the rights of same-sex marriage, following the Supreme Court's overturning of Roe v. Wade in June. The Democratic-led House passed a recent bill enshrining protection for same-sex marriage, fearing it may next face attack from the conservative-led Supreme Court following June's contentious decision and will likely prove to be a factor for November voters. Marriage equality is on the Senate's fall agenda. Leaked data reveals hundreds of law enforcement names on an Oath Keepers list, and portraits of the Obamas now have a permanent home at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. With more on the stories impacting our democracy, here's today's edition of 2022 Talks.
A vote will happen. A vote on marriage equality will happen on the Senate floor in the coming weeks.
Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer hopes to garner the 10 GOP votes needed to pass Democrats' bill to codify same-sex marriage. To gain Republican support, sponsors are working on an amendment to clarify the measure would not affect religious liberty or conscience protections. In July, 47 House Republicans supported a similar bill. Senator John Thune of North Dakota and other Republicans blasted the Biden administration's plan to forgive billions in student debt.
The Democrats demonstrated once again they don't care about fiscal responsibility. They don't care about debt or deficit reduction. Right now, they care about one thing, and that is buying votes going into a November election.
Democrat Elizabeth Warren defended the plan.
40% of those getting help do not have a college diploma. The unions were behind it. This was ultimately the Democrats doing what Democrats do best, helping working people.
A stopgap spending bill to fund the federal government is also on the fall agenda. It must be passed by the end of September. Leaked data released by the Anti-Defamation League revealed hundreds of people who signed up or expressed support for the Oath Keepers, hold elected office, or are active members of law enforcement or the military. The far-right extremist group is accused of playing a significant role in the January 6 attack on the U.S. Capitol. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis on Wednesday justified the recent arrest of 20 people in a new initiative to tackle voter fraud.
We want all voters who are lawful to vote to be able to vote, but if someone votes illegally, they could have canceled your vote out. How do you feel about that?
Those arrested are former felons who DeSantis says were convicted of crimes like murder and sexual assault. Voting rights groups accused DeSantis of undermining people's access to the ballot. South Carolina's governor plans to appeal a ruling barring the state from using a firing squad or electric chair for executions. The state has not carried out an execution in more than a decade due to problems obtaining the drugs necessary for lethal injection. Last year, lawmakers approved allowing inmates to choose between the three methods of execution.
Barack and Michelle, welcome home. Welcome home.
President Joe Biden greeted the former first couple at the White House for their official portrait unveiling ceremony, praising former President Obama as one of the most consequential presidents in history. Obama had kind words in return for his former vice president.
Thanks to your decency and thanks to your strength, maybe most of all, thanks to your faith in our democracy and the American people. The country's better off than when you took office, and we should all be deeply grateful for that.
I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
The James Smith Cree Nation holds vigil after a second suspect dies. And the NDN Collective opens Rapid City's first Indigenous-led school. With these stories and more, here's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
The intense manhunt for the prime suspect in a mass stabbing over the weekend in Saskatchewan is over. Miles Sanderson has died. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, he was facing murder charges linked to the stabbing deaths of 10 people and the wounding of at least 18 others.
Most of the victims were from the James Smith Cree Nation, about 120 miles northeast of Saskatoon. The community has been on edge and grieving since the stabbings took place early Sunday morning. One of the suspects, Damian Sanderson, was found dead on the reserve the following day. The other suspect, Miles Sanderson, his brother, became the target of a four-day manhunt across the province. That ended Wednesday afternoon on a highway about 40 miles northeast of Saskatoon, near the town of Rostern. Here's our CMP Assistant Commissioner, Rhonda Blackmore.
Our province is breathing a collective sigh of relief, as Miles Sanderson is no longer at large. I can confirm that he is no longer a threat, and there is no risk to the public related to this investigation.
After multiple tips from the public, officers stopped a stolen pickup truck and arrested Sanderson. Video shared from the scene showed the truck in a ditch surrounded by police cruisers with a police helicopter flying overhead. Blackmore says it was confirmed that the driver of the truck was Miles Sanderson.
He was arrested by police and taken into custody. Shortly after his arrest, he went into medical distress. Nearby, EMS were called by police to attend the scene, and he was transported to a hospital in Saskatoon. He was pronounced deceased at the hospital.
On Wednesday evening, members of the James Smith Cree Nation gathered for the first wake since the attacks. There will be more in coming days. As for the motive for the attacks, police say there may never be an answer. The RCMP has asked the Saskatoon Police Force and the province's Serious Incident Response Team to conduct an independent investigation into Sanderson's death. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
The Ocheti Shakoin Community Academy, or OSCA, has officially opened its doors in Rapid City. The move comes just weeks after the public school district's Lakota Immersion Program shut down. South Dakota Public Broadcasting CJ Keene has more.
The first class of Academy kindergartners was introduced to teachers on Tuesday at the city's first Indigenous-led and designed school. Indian Collective, a Rapid City-based Indigenous advocacy organization, founded the Academy. Indian Collective President Nick Tilson addressed the students.
To the little ones, you might think of, why are all these people here? Why did the drum come? Why did the elected leaders come? Why did all the grandparents come? They came here for one reason, and that's for you.
The curriculum includes daily lessons in the Lakota language and reflects subjects including environment, identity, culture, sovereignty, and treaties, along with general academic subjects. Mary Bowman works with the Indian Collective Education Equity Team. She has 15 years of education experience in the Rapid City area, and she compared the Academy's vision with her own educational background.
We learned in a very nurturing environment, and I don't feel like it's been that way for a long time. That wasn't my experience in education. I graduated from the Rapid City area schools. And I think just the opportunity to see themselves and what they're learning, that's a big thing. They're going to be motivated and engaged.
Bowman questioned the school district's efforts to sustain the Rapid City Lakota Immersion Program.
We want to see our Indigenous students do well, and we're not waiting for, you know, somebody to do something. We're getting out there and we're doing it. I think that effort was, it was a half-hearted effort, and I think that's part of the problem.
For National Native News in Rapid City, I'm CJ Keene.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
The use of health care services among children covered by Medicaid and CHIP declined during the pandemic. As Edwin J. Vieira reports, now as kids return to school, there are plenty of ways they can practice healthy habits, as well as plenty of ways for parents to keep their kids healthy.
As kids return to school, New York parents are encouraged to ensure their kids are getting yearly checkups. According to the U.S. Health Resources and Services Administration, the number of patients younger than 18 increased by about 1% between 2020 and 2021. However, this number has fluctuated since 2017. Although parents can get plenty of tests done at their kids' pediatrician, schools do offer hearing tests, according to Donna O'Shea with United Healthcare.
Like vision and dental, early detection of hearing issues is crucial for getting treatment as soon as possible. And that's really important because hearing loss can affect a child's ability to develop speech, language, and social skills.
O'Shea recommends kids follow the 60-60 rule, meaning they should only use earbuds or headphones for less than 60 minutes, at no more than 60% of the player's maximum volume. She says parents should ensure their kids are practicing healthy habits using technology. O'Shea provides tips on how to ensure kids use technology while preventing eye strain.
Make sure the computer screens are at least 30 inches away, or to make sure that you or your child are taking breaks every 20 minutes from the screens, and consider investing in screen protectors or computer monitors that help limit that exposure to blue light.
To keep a person's 20/20 vision, some recommend using the 20/20/20 rule. This involves taking a break from using a screen after 20 minutes by taking a 20-second break to look at something 20 feet away. I'm Edwin J. Vieira.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, September 8th, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Jeffrey Wade, Josh Salem, Mel Gertov, Suzanne Potter, Brett Pavido, and Edwin J. Vieira. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews.